KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and this year a visiting research collaborator at Princeton Center for Information Technology Policy. Today I'm very excited to have on Professor Lisa Lynch of Concordia University's Department of Journalism and, until very recently, a fellow at Princeton CITP, discussing her fascinating work involving leakers and leak websites. Most people who are paying attention to the world, even if you don't listen to Hearsay Culture, are becoming intimately familiar with how information suddenly appears on the internet. Fewer people, though still many, are familiar with the organizations around those most recent leaks, like WikiLeaks, and even the anonymous hacker group Anonymous that both shares information and also increasingly takes activist positions. But very few people have an understanding of the nature of leaking and the nature of information sharing, and particularly the intricacies of these ad hoc and formal organizations that are involved in putting any and all information on the internet for any and all individuals to share and use and digest and act upon. And Lisa's work focuses squarely in this area. And so I got to know Lisa a bit over the past semester at Princeton. As I promised my listeners, one of the things I would be doing while I have the fortune to be able to be at Princeton is to talk to the wonderful people there. And so Lisa is a perfect guest for this show, someone whose work I was familiar with prior to meeting her at Princeton, and I'm very excited to have her on the show today. Today we're going to talk about some of her recent writings in this area, including an article entitled, "Oh, WikiLeaks, I Would Love to Retreat You, WikiLeaks, Twitter, and Information Activism," which came out a short while ago in the International Journal of Communications, and other articles and other writings more generally involving this question of WikiLeaks and leak sites and what they do. Lisa, by way of background, as I mentioned, is a professor at Concordia University's Department of Journalism. She has a BA from Stanford, a master's from Berkeley, and a PhD in American Literature from Rutgers. Prior to her work now, she worked in the late 80s and early 90s as a magazine and newspaper journalist in the San Francisco Bay Area and in Pennsylvania. She also has written about the prison system, Guantanamo, and nuclear policy for both academic and popular publications. She focuses, as I mentioned now, at that intersection between culture, technology, and political change, which again makes it makes her and her work a perfect topic for this show. She has currently going a number of research projects in this area, and as I mentioned, not only does she write in this area, but she teaches really interesting courses that I would often, want to take, and many of my guests I just as soon would just enroll in their classes, including Digital Tools for Journalists and International Journalism. She is joining us via Skype today on January 13th, 2015. And Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
So let's start off with a question I ask most of my guests, which is tell us a bit more about your background and how you became interested in leakers and leak websites.
Well, as you noted in your introduction, I have a sort of circumlocuous path. I was a journalist for a while, and then I went back and got a doctorate in English, and was interested in my dissertation work was on narratives about epidemic disease. And so I became involved in really looking at culture and technology in that moment. And I was originally working in an English department in a Catholic university in Washington, D.C., and then they punted out all of us 20th century types into a media studies department. So while I was working in media studies, I became interested in the question of secrecy and information. And I did a project called the Guantanamo Project, where Elena Rezlagova, who's a colleague of mine in history now, and at that time was at the George Mason Center for History and New Media, she and I put together a project where we drove around the country with a documentary that we put together about the Guantanamo detentions. This is back in 2004, and we interviewed people, and we sort of created a layered media project about that. And so I was interested in the climate of secrecy and leaking around Guantanamo as a result of that. And so in 2007, I came across a Time story about a release of the Camp Delta Standard Operating Procedures manual. And this was an operating manual for Guantanamo, and it had been leaked by this organization called WikiLeaks. And this was the first time I'd heard about WikiLeaks, and that story was subsequently covered in The Post and BBC, AFP, UPI. It got a lot of press, and so I was curious about this organization, and I did some research. I found out that they had been around for a while, and that even though this was their first kind of big U.S. leak, they had been, releasing material about Kenya, about other places, and had started to kind of build a critical mass of followers, but were still kind of an outlier, something that a lot of people hadn't heard about. And then I discovered that the correspondence between the members of the founding members of WikiLeaks had itself been leaked on Crypto, which is another leaking site run by John Young. And it was like you got to, look at the way that this organization had kind of come about, what it wanted to do, what it was anxious about. And I was kind of hooked at that point and became really interested in WikiLeaks and what they were doing.
So when we talk about leaking generally, I mean, we're going to get into the weeds, but perhaps you could frame our discussion by talking broadly about what makes leaking information today different than prior to the internet. And obviously the internet itself might be the basis, but as we begin the discussion, what makes this a fertile topic of analysis and writing in your view?
Well, I mean, up until these leaking sites kind of came into being, most leaked information, that is information that is distributed sometimes strategically, by people within an organization to try to get information out, but also more commonly by whistleblowers trying to get information out about some kind of government or corporate malfeasance. Most of the time, that kind of leaking happened via contact between a whistleblower or someone else and a member of the media, and involved meeting in back rooms, cultivating relationships, that process was often very intimidating and very dangerous. Since 2001, in the climate after 9/11, there have been a lot more restrictions placed on, or strictures placed on journalists who have been working with leaked materials. So the climate around that kind of leaking had become more and more fraught. And what emerged online, first in small ways with organizations like John Young's Cryptone, are these sites that started to just upload leaked material that they received online that operated outside of the media. And Cryptone, which was one of the earliest sites, it didn't have a tremendous amount of security. Young worked with a PGP key, PGP encryption, but not a lot of security. And he was just uploading things that he obtained personally. But WikiLeaks had a very unique model in that they emphasized protecting their sources through what they described as a very, very secure, anonymous submission portal. And so what we saw with these online leaking sites increasingly, or what we've seen, is this focus on creating an anonymous submission portal that allows anybody really to go and put up leaked information without minimal risk and without necessarily developing a relationship with the site that eventually publishes your material. Now, as we'll talk about, that doesn't always play out in practice. Relationships are developed. Sometimes leakers are not necessarily anonymous. But what's new about the leaking sites is that ostensibly it lowers the bar to the leaking of information. And it also provides a forum outside of the media filter for leaked information, for better or for worse. So therefore, if information is released, you know, in the case of Cryptome or WikiLeaks or any of the sites that have come after it, it doesn't need to go through the filter of the mainstream media to be declared relevant or of interest.
So is there a way to define leaking that varies from what a colloquial definition of it would be, which is simply sharing information in an unauthorized manner? Is there more to it than that?
Well, there are lots of different kinds of leaks. I mean, I think that that it's important, especially when you talk about leaked journalism or journalism that is motivated or catalyzed by leaking. It's important to realize the role that the government actually plays in strategically leaking information, and that articles that have been written that seem to be created through adversarial leaking, often in the recent past in the United States, are not created necessarily through adversarial leaking, but through strategic leaking to create the appearance of an adversarial journalism when none actually exists. For example, it's emerged that some of the reporting that Douglas Gell was doing connecting in the years following 9/11, who was then a reporter at the New York Times, he's now the foreign editor at the Washington Post. Some of that reporting was actually leaked reporting, but it was done because he had a strategic relationship with folks in the government and folks in the military that wanted to create a certain kind of story about a series of events. And so for Gell, he got leaked material in return for promises that he would soft pedal certain kinds of information. So leaking is not always adversarial. I think it's really important to realize that, but the kind of leaking that we see on these leaking sites that we're talking about is generally much more adversarial. It's generally much more of an involuntary nature.
So that lack of adversarial relationships and action in certain situations versus, as you just pointed out, Lisa, the seemingly obvious adversarial or at least, if nothing else, very charged releasing of information by WikiLeaks is where we're going to head now. We're chatting with Professor Lisa Lynch of Concordia University on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So you know, WikiLeaks, of course, you know, for many listeners and many people, is a known entity. However, for those that haven't gotten into the weeds here, perhaps a basic background on WikiLeaks would be helpful. So how do you describe WikiLeaks in a 2 to 3 minute span?
So WikiLeaks comes together over the course of 2006 and 2007. It's the brainchild of Julian Assange, who subsequently becomes the figurehead for the organization. And it's a loose collective of folks, as he describes them, you know, journalists, hackers, and activists, who are interested in trying to create this leaking platform with incredibly good computer security for anonymous leaking. And it has very global aspirations, especially in the beginning. It's not focused, as some people have, you know, subsequently assumed, and it's not focused on an adversarial relationship to the United States government. It's focused on this kind of idea of a global forced transparency that is both government and corporate. So in fact, you know, most of the early leaks were from outside of the United States, sort of global in nature and looked at both political and corporate malfeasance in Africa, in Asia, in various parts of Europe. And in terms of the structure of the organization, I would say that, you know, it's obviously it's always been Assange. The leaking platform was developed by someone called the Architect, whose identity we still aren't sure of. Although Andy Greenberg interviewed him for his book, This Machine's Kill Secrets. So a few people know who he is, but he's not publicly known. And then there've been you know, anywhere from dozens to scores of volunteers in the circle around WikiLeaks, some of them, you know, who we know and some of them who we're not familiar with. So the organization has expanded and contracted a great deal over time. And although it has no formal structure, it's always had a number of known individuals.
You mentioned something there with regard to WikiLeaks, Lisa, that I think is useful to get into a little bit. You mentioned the lack of adversarial, or at least the lack of direct focus on governments. And I'm curious about that because certainly I think, again, colloquially, many people, if not most, would view WikiLeaks as directly opposed in the sense of operating in a very different interest towards governments, given many of the public pronouncements of Julian Assange. For example, on WikiLeaks' own website, they have wallpapers, which I find modestly humorous, that you can put on your computer that say things like, it's time to open the vault, and organizations are all built on a mountain of secrets, which is a quote, a paraphrase of Julian Assange. So how do you square those kinds of statements with a view of WikiLeaks as not being opposed to government generally?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question. I mean, I think that in a way, WikiLeaks evolved in response to what it, you know, to its megaleaks. And that, you know, ever since 2010, when they worked with the Bradley Manning material, the collateral murder video, the war logs, and then the Cablegate material, they've had such a tremendous pushback from the U.S. government, from governments around the world, that that they've become much more focused on this issue of government response to secrecy, and I think that that's a lot that a lot of its follower base became really interested in this idea of pushing back against governments, but I think that corporate transparency, you know, was always a great interest of Assange, and in fact I think it's important to realize that some of their significant leaks have been corporate leaks. For example, the leaks regarding activities at the Kaupthing Bank in Iceland, which were so important to the kind of political restoration, the political upheaval and debates in Iceland, and created such strong support for WikiLeaks in Iceland. Those were corporate leaks. They had, you know, they had a great deal, in fact, of material, supposedly connected to the Bank of America that would have come out were it not for all of the things that, that happened subsequent to the mega leaks. I think, it's both government and corporate transparency that sets the initial aim of WikiLeaks as an endeavor, and I think continues to be the aim of WikiLeaks as it persists, but certainly the mega leaks skewed the direction and focus, or the perception of the direction and focus of the organization, because it became what they were known for.
So let me ask you one more pushback type question on this, because what you're saying, I think, is different than certainly, again, the colloquial or, you know, more, generalized view of WikiLeaks. So several years ago now, I had, Stephen Aftergood on from the Federation of American Scientists, who, as you know, does a wonderful, list and posting of information related to national security and makes tons of freedom of information requests to get information and so forth. He wrote an essay a few years ago with regard to WikiLeaks and Assange, particularly after the Chelsea Manning revelations. And I'm paraphrasing him, but I want to get your reaction to it. What he said more eloquently than I'm going to is that with regard to the reasons for WikiLeaks behaviors, and we're going to talk about WikiLeaks in more detail in a moment, and your studies of, if you will, the taxonomy of leak sites, he pointed out, and it was his view, that what WikiLeaks was about was not about improving the world, was not about peace, but it was merely because WikiLeaks doesn't like secrets. And so, again, I'm paraphrasing it, but basically his view, or certainly a takeaway from the article, was don't ascribe more reasons or more goals to WikiLeaks than simply the erosion of secrets. Again, based upon my paraphrase, what's your reaction to that take on WikiLeaks, and as we're going to talk about in a moment, particularly Assange?
Well, Aftergood's been a persistent antagonist of WikiLeaks since the beginning. I think that that he was always, you know, a particularly unsympathetic person. I don't think he trusted their, you know, and without defending WikiLeaks, you know, and I'll go on to be more critical, but I think Aftergood has always been someone who distrusted everything, intentions, motivations, results, from the get-go. But he does have a point in the sense that if you look at the dossier of early WikiLeaks disclosures, there is, you know, there is some random material that caused, some people to become extremely impatient with the organization, like, you know, fraternity handbooks, for example, didn't seem to be in the mandate of, you know, creating a world free from government or corporate secrecy. There were always things that just seemed to be going up for the heck of it. And in fact, Assange did say on some occasions that they didn't want to suppress material. So they weren't really using a filter for some of the things that they put up. And so whether or not that was a particularly, wise decision on their part, or, you know, I think we can call into question, but I think you can separate the clear aspirations of the organization, which I think we can separate the aspirations of the organization from some of the things that happened on the WikiLeaks platform. And I think it's also important to remember that even though, you know, it's difficult to talk about WikiLeaks as an entity in many ways because of its lack of formal structure, just as it's very difficult to talk about Anonymous as an entity in many ways. But I don't think that, you know, and I think it's also possible to suspect the methods of certain people within the organization at certain times, and to think that certain people who were very involved with WikiLeaks were specifically antagonistic towards the U.S. government in certain moments, or specifically antagonistic towards other targets. But I don't doubt that some of the nobler aims of people in the group, even if those aims didn't always play out.
So Lisa, with regard to that last point, you don't speak about these issues merely from having studied them from afar, but you've also interacted with Assange personally. So perhaps you could talk about those interactions and your impressions of him.
Since I started talking about WikiLeaks really early, when the organization was really just getting its sea legs, at the time that I started kind of researching and talking about WikiLeaks, they were meticulously documenting all of the press that they were getting, and they actually put out like a dossier of all of the articles, and then talked about how, you know, WikiLeaks had catalyzed all of this reporting in different places. And so they were in a sense watching the watchers, closely looking at anyone who was paying attention to them. So the first time I gave a paper, which was at a conference at MIT, they got a copy of the paper and they put it out on their Twitter stream. And then the second time I gave a paper, which was at a conference in Cardiff, Wales, it was a closed conference on the future of journalism. I remember was sitting there and the audience went in to get up and give my paper, and I realized that WikiLeaks had tweeted several times that they were trying to get someone in the room to leak them a copy of the paper. And so I emailed the organization. I'm like, you know, it's like there's 40 media scholars in a room in Wales. It's not really, you know, something that you need to be so concerned with, but I'll eventually share this paper with you. Well, then, you know, several weeks later, I was interviewed for my undergraduate paper at the university that I was teaching at Concordia, and the student mentioned something on WikiLeaks, and lo and behold, they tweet the article from the paper, and they say on their Twitter feed, this woman, you know, claims to be writing about us, but she hasn't been in contact with us, and, you know, something derogatory. And that was really one of the first times I'd ever gotten flamed, because of course then, there was, you know, a cascade of, remarks from followers about because it was a photo of my hair, you know, whatever, you know, my future. And so then I got in touch with them again, and I was like, look, you know, you don't really need to do this. I told you I was going to send you the paper, and, you know, you're paying a little too much attention to me. And so then Assange got back to me, and we emailed back and forth a couple of times, and I wound up sending him this paper, and he returned it to me, you know, meticulously copy edited, and with some really great suggestions. I mean, some of the points that I made in the paper he didn't agree with, but he was, you could tell just from the exchange just how amazingly meticulous he was, and also how paradoxically concerned he was, and this has been, you know, a persistent theme that many people have brought up about WikiLeaks, about reputation and image and controlling the message, you know, that is one of the great paradoxes at the heart of WikiLeaks, was their attempt to sort of really control the message and, you know, at the same time, liberate information for the rest of the world. So I got to see that in action in communicating with him. And then, of course, you know, shortly after all of that played out, the media attention towards WikiLeaks exploded because all of these things started happening, and they started keeping much less of a watch on people who were writing about them. So I became much less important to their universe. After that.
We're chatting with Professor Lisa Lynch of Concordia University on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is on KZSU, which is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu or click on Donate to KZSU at our website. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the station. So Lisa, let's turn, I guess, a little bit more broadly towards some of the work that you've done describing leak sites more broadly. And we're going to, you know, come back to WikiLeaks and Assange shortly. But you have a general view of the terrain of leak sites. You've mentioned it a bit already with Cryptome and WikiLeaks, and even to the extent anonymous. If you're thinking about the common elements that these entities share beyond an interest in disclosing information, what would it be? Or what are they?
Common elements. Well, I mean, I think, first of all, you want to talk
if there are any.
Yeah, there are. I mean, John Young's site, Cryptome, and then another site, Public Intelligence, which was started in 2009. I think both of those sites still exist, and both of them kind of sprung up, I would say, independently of WikiLeaks. Public Intelligence, the site is run by Michael Haynes. Again, Cryptome run by John Young. Those are organizations which focus on the same kind of material as WikiLeaks or some of the other leaking sites, but for them, they're really one-man shops, and they're not as much about security. So that's one kind of leaking site. But I think you can trace a sort of trajectory from WikiLeaks onwards. There are many, many sites that have, you know, come and gone, many now that still exist, which really focus on this idea of creating this anonymous, secure leaking platform. and offering this idea that if you create an anonymous secure leaking platform, sort of the field of dreams, if you build it, they will come theory. You know, and so WikiLeaks really was the first one to really push this idea. And then we've seen since then, you know, many sites come afterwards. And the first one to come up in the wake of WikiLeaks or to attempt to come up was OpenLeaks, which was a site that was going to be developed by Daniel Damchat-Bialik, who was someone who had been a spokesperson at WikiLeaks and ruptured with the organization in a pretty dramatic way. And according to WikiLeaks, Enveric himself destroyed a lot of the information that WikiLeaks was going to release. So Berg then went around and said that he was going to create a better version of WikiLeaks. He got a lot of support, but his platform that he was developing, OpenLeaks, really never came to be. So it wound up being a dead end, although a lot of people assumed that that was going to be what WikiLeaks was going to eventually evolve into. But at the same time, you saw just dozens of smaller sites, and these are really described well in Andy Greenberg's book, This Machine Kills Secrets, and also in, there's a site called Leak Directory, which was created by the MIT Center for Civic Media, if you're interested in looking at these sites, but they were created usually by small groups or individuals, everything from RU Leaks for Russian Leaks, Revenue Watch, Indo Leaks, Irish Leaks, Enviro Leaks, Quebec Leaks for Quebec, where I am now, Science Leaks, Corporate Leaks, Baltic Leaks, Pirate Leaks. So we saw this kind of proliferation of these little leaking sites. Some of them were incredibly insecure. They claimed to be much more secure than they were, and they were actually a bit dangerous. Some of them were a bit better than others, and most of them kind of came and went within the space of a year or two, because they really couldn't, they either didn't attract leaks, no one came, or they really couldn't keep together organizationally. But then what happened was that two separate groups decided to work on this idea of creating a secure leaking platform. And these two groups were the Secure Drop groups, which was a group that was more connected to the media, and then this organization called Global Leaks, which was created by the Hermes Foundation, which was an Italian transparency organization. And so Secure Drop has become this platform largely used by the media. So sites like The Guardian uses it, New Yorker uses it, ProPublica uses it, The Intercept uses Secure Drop, whereas Global Leaks is often used by activist groups and by smaller organizations. For example, there's a group called Enviro Leaks, which has just come up, which uses Global Leaks, and which has been, they claim that they've been really successful at getting a lot of leaks connected to the environmental movement. So there are these two players now who are really the future, I think, of leaking. The Secure Drop folks and the Global Leaks folks, and they're talking about possibly coordinating, but they really serve a slightly different constituency. Global Leaks really working with, more, like I said, more activist groups, and Secure Drop being something that you find in-house at a lot of media organizations.
So, Lisa, let's turn for a moment to what I think is a really fascinating challenge that we have in the world of dealing with leaked sites, and that's governmental reactions to them. As someone who's, you know, followed these sites, not as closely as you to be sure, but certainly followed them not only because of my interest in information flows, but also because particularly the leaks that WikiLeaks put up over the last few years from the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, where they put leaked drafts of negotiating texts or whatever, has been used substantively by me, as well as to analyze lawmaking. It's been very interesting to me to see how governments have reacted to WikiLeaks. And I'll give you an example of what I mean before I ask the question. As you know, the Chelsea Manning leaks went out, I remember reading directives that had been issued by the State Department telling governmental employees that they could not use or even look at these sites, which you know, is certainly comical from the perspective of the fact that the information is out there, and then from a lawyer's perspective, how you enforce such a rule is also a challenge. So with that kind of backdrop, you know, what's your take on the governmental, I'm going to put aside corporations for a moment, the governmental reaction to leak sites and WikiLeaks in particular, given that their general reaction from what I've seen is to either pretend that they're not there or attempt to litigate or threaten them into oblivion. What's your read on that? And by the way, if you, you know, you can certainly dispute my characterization of the reaction as well.
No, I mean, I think, it was humorous, some of the reaction to Cablegate. I mean, you saw, you know, the Library of Congress not being able to link to any of the information. There was, a speech, someone, I believe, from the State Department told journalism students that they told state students who were interested in going into the Foreign Service that if it occurred that they had ever browsed WikiLeaks, that they could, you know, consider their careers over. So this kind of, this is sort of looking the other way, aspect of the response was humorous, although I have to say not new, and I'm sure that, you know, in your own work you've come across this before. I remember when I was doing work on Guantanamo and dealing with some of the lawyers, having them, you know, they would get material from the government and the government would call them back and say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, we've subsequently classified what we sent you, can you send it back, and you never saw it. So I think that that kind of wishing the people didn't see things, that whimsical approach to secrecy has been a long time feature of the U.S. government and other governments. But in terms of larger government reaction, I mean, I think for me what interests me is, you know, the way that WikiLeaks intersects with this global movement on transparency, which has been around for this time, you know, for about two decades now. So we see the sort of the rise of the global transparency movement and this slow, you know, gradual embrace by most Western governments and some outside of the West of this idea, particularly, you know, in India, this idea of transparency as a principle of government operation. And so what we saw simultaneously in the United States or in Canada was, you know, this public embrace of this notion of government transparency by the government at the same time that they're trying to shut down what's happening at WikiLeaks, you know, and other sites, and characterizing this as you know, leaking sites as a form of subversion, not transparency. They had to bracket it, you know, as the other. But I think that's completely to be expected. I mean, forced transparency is a very specific kind of transparency. And, you know, some political scholars have written about this. I mean, there are a lot of people who don't believe in this whole idea of forcing government transparency, who, you know, political theorists who find it inherently just destabilizing. I don't think you can ever imagine that a government would be supportive of the idea of forced transparency unless it's about somebody else. You know, I think that the best that you can hope for in terms of a government response is that they not try to criminalize it. But I can't imagine, you know, we've never seen an example of a government being, you know, affirmative in the response to forced transparency.
And that notion of radical transparency, which, you know, underscores what WikiLeaks does, this, you know, not entirely new, but relatively new term for the general normative view that sharing all information without limits is a good thing, seems to, you know, be the prism through which governments and corporations view any interest in having information that's otherwise secret being made public. Along those same lines, another challenging technology or behavior for governments is, of course, social media. And you've written about how WikiLeaks uses social media like Twitter. Perhaps you could talk a bit about their, to the extent that you have a sense of it, their social media strategy. And does it surprise you, given the nature of the information that they share, that they would use social media to the extent that they do?
Well, yeah, I think WikiLeaks and Twitter is a very, you know, it's a really interesting history because they kind of come of age at the same time. When WikiLeaks first starts up on Twitter, and they initially WikiLeaks decides to go on Twitter because they've been sending out email blasts to reporters that they've been putting on a mailing list announcing their leaks, and they feel like they're not getting enough media coverage. So they figure like, oh, we'll go out on Twitter, and then the media will follow us, and that'll be a better way of communicating. So what happened is they opened up a Twitter account, but it really didn't get followed by folks in the media until relatively late in the game. Their early Twitter followers weren't members of the media, but fans, and mostly from the kind of technology community and the political activist community. So for a while, WikiLeaks, you know, realizes, you know, over time that they're on Twitter, that they're interacting with their fan base. It's not a site for media outreach as much as it is for getting support, getting donations, getting reassurance from their fan base. And they begin to kind of act accordingly on Twitter. You know, they begin to address their fans on Twitter via the medium. And then when the media does join and start following WikiLeaks and reporting what WikiLeaks is doing on Twitter, it's almost this kind of invasion of this space, which is constructed quite differently. You know, the media is looking at what WikiLeaks is doing on Twitter, but WikiLeaks is talking to their fans. They're not really talking to the media by that point. And so when the media begins to engage with WikiLeaks directly on Twitter, what you see is this kind of really sometimes hilarious adversarial engagement between WikiLeaks and figures in the media, where people start calling each other names and casting aspersions. You know, they're like the legendary Twitter feuds between Julian Assange and David Lay, for example, from The Guardian. And The Guardian, of course, had been one of WikiLeaks' quote-unquote media partners for the release of a lot of their information, but they'd had a falling out, you know, largely based on a falling out between Assange and Lay. And so Twitter became a place during the WikiLeaks mega leaks period where you saw the Assange going after figures in the media, and you saw also media folks kind of airing their dirty laundry within media organizations about the fact that everyone felt differently about WikiLeaks. It's quite entertaining.
Yeah, for sure. And then
in terms of whether this was wise for WikiLeaks, I mean, I think for a long time, you know, many organizations, you know, since Twitter was really an untested ground, people, you know, thought of it as a safe space for activist organizing and as a great place for creating community. And it WikiLeaks, again, was the canary in the coal mine. When their Twitter records were subpoenaed by the government in 2011, that was what made a lot of people stand up and realize that Twitter was not quite the safe space many people assumed it would be. So perhaps they shouldn't have had as many conversations on Twitter as they ultimately did, but they were not alone in thinking of Twitter as a somewhat different space than it turned out to be.
We're chatting with Professor Lisa Lynch of Concordia University on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Lisa, we're entering what I call the unfair portion of the show, where having had the luxury to give long and detailed answers to my questions, time runs short, and sometimes I have to cut you off. But then as a host, I ask the questions anyway. So here we go. We talked about the governmental role. I do think, and you've alluded to it several times, that corporations, of course, are also subject to leaks. And of course, you know, as we're recording this show on January 13th, 2015, I'd certainly be remiss and be engaging in malpractice as an interviewer if I didn't mention the Sony leak that occurred at this point, roughly a month ago or so. Which, as of this recording, it's still unclear, at least based upon governmental versus as private security researchers' reactions to it, whether it was a North Korean government or some kind of inside job, former or current employee trade secret leak. What's your take on the Sony leaks, pivoting the corporations, as it relates to the role of WikiLeaks and leak sites generally? And I'll ask, although you may not have an opinion, do you have an opinion as to who's behind this massive leak of information?
I'll take the second part first. I've always been skeptical of the North Korea claim, although, the FBI seems to be in true Rumpelstiltskin fashion, you know, kind of jumping up and down and insisting that no, it's the truth that that North Korea is the origin of the leaks. So I mean, eventually I think the truth will out, but I guess I remain skeptical. I don't know. I was thinking about the Sony leaks in terms of WikiLeaks. You know, one thing that I think is that, you know, I think they definitely, you know, WikiLeaks would have loved to get that traceship material.
I was wondering that as well. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that would have been something that, that I think that they would have reveled in. And I think an interesting thing about it is if they had gotten that material, I think that, that they would have tried to direct the story in certain ways. I think that they would focus on, the inequity in salaries. I think that they would have, I think that they would have kind of cherry picked out several things that they thought represented various forms of injustice or wrongdoing and tried to push that message more. So in a way, I think that if the material had been distributed via the WikiLeaks, that you might have seen more coherent media narratives about the leaks. Well, partially because the question wouldn't have been so much who did the leaking as what the material was.
Well, and related to that, Lisa, is a question that this is a good time to get to it, which is methods, right? Mm-hmm. Methods for getting information. Of course, you know, again, if you go with the government narrative, this was a straight up hack, right? Unauthorized intrusion into a computer network, as opposed to, right, the alternative narrative coming again from security researchers outside government this is really an inside job. In other words, someone who already had or may have had authorized access to the information releases it in an unauthorized way. Do we know how WikiLeaks gets its information? In other words, to ask the tough question, is there reason to think that WikiLeaks is engaged not just in receiving information that others make available to it, but either involved directly in hacking or in encouraging, right, and therefore arguably being part of an authorized intrusion itself? Do we have a sense of how they get the information they do?
Well, they've always been very, very firm that this is not something that they do. The one thing that there's been some debate about when there was a profile of Assange in the New Yorker several years back, and in that profile there was a suggestion that they might have gotten a lot of their early material by sniffing a Tor exit point. In other words, by going on to Tor, which, as we know, anonymizes but doesn't encrypt, and finding a large traceship materials that had actually been assembled by Chinese hackers, so that this material hadn't been submitted to WikiLeaks, it had actually they'd sort of stumbled across someone the result of someone else's hack. And Assange went on to again vigorously deny that was the case, and to insist that all the material that they had gotten had been submitted to them. That doesn't quite square with their initial announcement that they had, you know, almost a million documents. There was a suggestion that certainly some of the material that they had gotten, they had gotten in bulk in some way. But I would say that it's probably not the case that they were going out and doing the kind of work that, say, Anonymous does to procure material.
So as we again, about 5 minutes left, and we think about this cacophony of information that's flooding towards us. There are other examples that you've written about, which we're not going to get the time to cover today. But I'll ask you this question, right? With regard to public consumption of this information, right? How or where should the public be focusing its interest? In other words, how should or what do you think the public could or should not be doing to deal with the fact that information is coming from an unauthorized source, as you've alluded to, for people that want to go into certain career paths? There are threats that come, whether, again, those threats are enforced is a separate question, from future employers. If you're a member of the public and you have an interest in this information, what do you do? Do you say, to heck with it, and just go ahead and surf the web, assuming you have the interest in time? Do you avoid? What would you suggest the public, generally, people that want to be informed, should do when they come across leaked information or whether when they want to get the leaked information?
Well, I mean, I think that looking to the future, I think that the there's a great fear that consumption of information or pointing to leaked information is going to become increasingly criminalized. At the moment, that's not the case, and it's certainly a dystopic dystopic view to think that in the future, some of the things that, as I said, some of the more whimsical things that people were talking about around Cablegate, which I think were not really enforceable in that moment. It's scary to think in the future that there might be more strictures placed on even engaging with the kind of material that we saw emerging from WikiLeaks. But, I mean, I think it's something that we need to be vigilant about because it's something that certainly, there are people in government who would want there to be more restrictions on looking at this kind of information. But I think that, I think it's important. It's really important to pay attention to the material that's coming out, on these sites, not only for the, you know, for the sake of looking at things that other people want, to be hidden, but, you know, leaking often reveals that someone is concerned that something is going wrong somewhere. And so, in a way, all of these leaking sites can serve as bellwethers to issues that won't otherwise be put on the table. You know, sometimes we're going to come across things like, as I referred to, you know, the fraternity manuals that were leaked on WikiLeaks, which aren't of any consequence. But there's a lot of material that's out there, not because people are disgruntled, as may be the case with Sony, but because people are really staking, you know, their own personal safety on the line because they think that there's a legitimate problem that needs attention drawn to it. And so I think that's where these sites are continuing to serve a function, although I believe that they're going to evolve a great deal, you know, in the immediate future as well.
And let me ask one last question on an evolution, recognizing, again, unfair questions, right? It's rare for me to end an interview with a pushback question. I'm going to do it here because I think it's useful, right? One of the pushbacks has been particularly in the case of revealing governmental information, but also, you know, corporate information is that lives, in the case of governmental information, and, you know, things like leaking information about the world of security through people like Edward Snowden, who we didn't talk about today, but who might be another example, right, leads to people dying. And so members of the intelligence community have said explicitly that Snowden's leaks, for example, can and will lead to people losing their lives. You also have on the corporate side, of course, embarrassment. Now, there's of course, a gulf between embarrassment for saying something ill-advised or worse and someone losing their life. But how should we think about leak sites in light of that risk? And do you think that risk is real? Unfair question, Lisa. I'll give you a minute on that one.
I think that risk is absolutely real, and I also think it has absolutely not been realized. I think that it's a very convenient thing to say when you want to express disapproval of leaked material, but as far as we know, none of the claims about loss of life have really been borne out in any of the cases of either the WikiLeaks, MegaLeaks, or the Snowden leaks. Those are certainly careers and reputations have doubtless been damaged. So I'm not going to say that that would never be a concern, because I think that if we increasingly see this kind of mass leaking, then we're going to see collateral damage. It's inevitable. We haven't seen that yet, but I could see that it could happen in the future. But I also think that, you know, in the case of the Snowden leaks, that there's been some vigilance, some attempt to hold material back. And there certainly was during the MegaLeaks period, although we know that that there was also some sloppiness.
Professor Lisa Lynch of Concordia University, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. Of course, this issue is far from going away. It's only getting more complicated, but your work helps us understand it. So thank you so much, Lisa, for joining us today on the show.
You're quite welcome.
So there's a number of guests we have coming on the show this quarter. KZSU revealed its schedule for the winter just yesterday. Again, we're recording the show on January 13th for airing a week from tomorrow. Hearsay Culture will air this quarter it appears to be noon to 1 p.m. on Wednesdays, and so you can listen to the show there live by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu. There are a number of great guests coming up this quarter. Last week you heard from Sullen Barocas, postdoctoral research associate at Princeton Center for Information Technology Policy. Coming up for the remaining number of shows for the quarter include professors Alexander Glazier and Zia Meon of Princeton University, co-authors of Unmaking the Bomb, a Fissile Material Approach to Nuclear Disarmament and Nonproliferation. We're also going to be hearing from Professor Biela Coleman of McGill University, author of Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, The Many Faces of Anonymous, fitting very nicely into our discussion today with Lisa. Stephanie Pell and Chris Segoyan on Stingray Technology, again involving surveillance, two terrific guests that have been on the show before, who co-authored a really interesting article on this topic in Harvard's Journal of Law and Technology. Sita Gersis, postdoctoral fellow in the Media, Cultural, and Communications Department at NYU and in the Information Law Institute at NYU Law School. Again, professor, another CITP former fellow, Professor Raul Rojas of Free University of Berlin, and Bo Woods on driverless cars. Jonathan Mayer, Stanford PhD candidate in computer science, and Jack Rabbit, the editor-in-chief and founder of the legendary music magazine The Big Takeover, a magazine that has focused on the punk and new wave movements for decades, and someone who's been around the underground media world for decades. And so I'm excited to have Jack on the show as well. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. Again, noon Wednesdays on KZSU Live this quarter. You can also get the show by going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School, or by going to the webpage for CIS at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for listening today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.